Okay, it's the 9th of May, and we're going to be discussing margin, buying on margin, and shorting. Two other things that I hope you never do. Maybe someday you'll buy on margin, maybe. When is the final exam? 21st. May 21st, 23rd is the other class. If you're not going to be here, if you're going to go to Cancun or wherever, contact me so we can make provisions, because that's it. That's it. So make sure you contact me. If you're not going to be here, we'll make other provisions. And we'll discuss the final in detail next week. I haven't created it yet, but I will give you the questions for everything we've done after the fourth exam. In other words, what we did on Tuesday when we discussed options and futures contracts, and then what we're going to do today with buying and selling, buying on margin, shorting, things that I don't want you to do, but you need to know about them. Okay? Is that cool? So we'll discuss it in detail next week. And anybody have any more Baffle the Broker things they want to ask? I finally got some good stuff from you guys yesterday. Any other questions about life, the universe, financial investments? Did you have it, Baffle the Broker? Yes? Okay, good. Thank you. That's it. I like it. It's fun. What can you say? Okay, so. Where are we? Well, we come back a little bit. We were down to 112 just a few moments ago. But look, it was down about 4 or 5% today. But still, we're up 13% even after P&J. You know. This is the perfect day to discuss shorting. This is the perfect day because you know he's doing it. He, not him. He's got to have somebody else do it, because if he did it, all these bells and whistles would go off. Okay. But first we need a good joke. Anybody got a joke? No? Did I tell you about the three junkies, heroin addicts that were sharing needles? No, this is serious, right? Their buddy comes up and says, I told you guys, don't do that. It's dangerous. You get AIDS that way. They said, no, it's cool. Everything's cool. We're all wearing condoms. Dumb. What? Dumb. Okay, I'm sorry. I just love dumb jokes. I just love dumb jokes. Okay. Well, you know, life is a terminal disease. So you either cry or you can laugh at it. And so I like to laugh at it. So let's get started. Oh, by the way, we saw this. Okay. So let's get started on, what did I do it on? Right here. Buying and selling securities, but specifically buying on margin and shorting stocks or any other securities, because we're going to work on chapter 2 today. Chapter 2? This is the end of the semester. Why are we working on chapter 2? That doesn't make any sense. Well, as we'll see, I disagree vehemently with where the book... And everybody's using the book, right? You're all using the book? No, you're not using the book? I disagree vehemently, as an extra, with the placement of chapter 2 in the textbook. Because, as we said at the beginning... As we said at the beginning of the semester, when we did the group project, where we all chose 10 stocks, they want you throughout the class to be treating it like a competition, a horse race, or what do you want to call it. And so they want to explain to you how to do certain transactions, including stuff that you really shouldn't even touch, short sales, especially if you're just getting started. And so that's why I put this at the very ending. And they talk about different brokerage firms. Now, we already made mention of places like Merrill Stench and Morgan Stupid, where they want you to have $50,000, now $100,000, $500,000. You get a personal broker. You're going to pay pretty high commissions. More and more, they're using the new model, which we'll see in a bit, The discount brokers are mostly gone. They used to sometimes be called the mom and pop shops. And what are left is Schwab, and then I think Edward Jones, A.G. Edwards. I think they've been subsumed by somebody else. But you probably see around, you drive around, you'll see a shop, Edward Jones. And those are discount brokers. They typically charge about $30 to $45 a trade. Schwab, though, has basically sort of eaten them alive. And now, I think, anybody use Schwab? I think they're $9 a trade. Anybody use Schwab? And then the deep discount brokers, the E-Trash and Snot Trade, they have emphasized the Internet. It's not like everybody else is using it, but they've emphasized technology to reduce costs dramatically. What kind of service can we expect? Well, commissions then and now. Virtually all brokerage firms made their money traditionally from commissions, but that's changing. Full-service brokers would charge you $70 to $100 per trade. But these are people usually that were throwing $10,000, $12,000 per stock. They might have 10, 20 stocks. So $100 a trade, no big deal. Then the discount brokers, as we said, started with $45, now they're down to $29, $19 now. Schwab at $9 a trade. And then the deep discount brokers started at $15 to $18, now they're down to $5 or less. And the mutual fund companies have gotten into the act. Anybody have an account with Fidelity or Vanguard? They have their own brokerage firms. Now, it's not the same company, but it has the same name, right? Called Fidelity something or other Investments. Fidelity Investments is the mutual fund company, and the brokerage firm, I'm not sure what they're called, but it's a brokerage firm, and you can buy their own mutual funds without any commission whatsoever. So it's a very smart marketing organization. Now, how many people have Robinhood? You folks, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Six already have Robinhood. See, these are very popular with younger folks. Obviously, we're seeing this. There were a couple others that failed. One has changed to $5 a trade. But Robinhood has become very popular, and it looks like they're going to make it because there's a lot of money behind them. I don't know how the hell they're making money off a $0 trade. We do know that they're making money off the what's called the order flow, the kickback. We're going to come back to that slide in a bit. But they say they want to start charging interest using margin accounts, but they haven't been okayed for margin accounts yet. We're going to discuss margin accounts today. So I don't know how Robinhood's staying in business, but then again,
they do have margin.
They have margin now?
There's something called Robinhood Gold, which lets you borrow.
Oh, so they have.
It lets you borrow points that are money. Yeah.
Whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah.
They let you borrow points?
Yeah. Robinhood Gold.
Robinhood Gold, and then what you can do with these points?
It's a line of credit, basically.
It's a line of credit.
People do use it as short and margin.
So maybe they're. I haven't been following them because I'm not interested, but I should be interested because that's what the young folks want to play with. And that's the next generation. So if they have margining, they'll make money off of interest, which we'll see today is how some brokers make their money. But how can a brokerage firm make any money with a $0 commission? Remember this slide? What's going on? So when your people say, oh, yeah, Robinhood's free, you tell them, no, it's not. You're paying something. You don't see what you're paying. But in case of Scottrade, they will tell you if you ask them. But, of course, nobody asks them, so they don't understand what this means. But you're paying a higher price when you buy. You're getting a lower price when you sell. But that's what you understand if you got your eyes wide open. Is it a tremendous amount of money? No, it's not much. It's much less than paying $70 or $100 a trade, from Merrill Lynch or Morgan Stanley. But just so you understand, just so you have your eyes open, so you understand that you're not really getting it for free. Okay, now, as the competition for your business has gotten fiercer, the methods of charging investors for investment services have gotten more creative. Merrill Lynch experimented with charging $3,000 per year for unlimited trades, but they got rid of that. And now, what we see is assets under management, wealth management, the new way to soak your clients. I'm sorry. Charge for brokerage services is a wealth management account, also called a wrap account, a financial advisor account, investment advisor account. Instead of charging per transaction, the brokerage firm tax on a yearly 0.5%. I just saw that because we have a mortgage through Wells Fargo, Wells Fallow, they just sent me the solicitation. They're charging 0.5, 0.5%. The first I've seen is 0.5%. I saw one by somebody below of 1%. But it's typically anywhere from 1% to 2%. We discussed these when we looked at mutual funds, remember the F-shares? So these type of programs are being pushed by all the major full-service brokerage firms, and there are many different flavors. The newest wrinkle, it's actually not that new, it's about 12 years old now, is the performance-based wealth management. So you understand what's going on. You maybe have $100,000, they're taking $1,000. Maybe you have $1 million, they're taking $10,000. Maybe you have $1,000, they're taking $10. They're taking 1%. And I've seen it as high as 2%. Did I tell you a little story about this one woman who was going to get charged 2%? And I explained to her what was going on. They were people from her church. Never mix religion and finance, folks. Under God, render under God, which is God. Render under Caesar, which is Caesar. And so she went back and said, he said you're going to charge me 2%. Oh, we'll charge you 1%. They're still screwing her. Right? They're still screwing her. But hey, this is part of the job. So performance-based wealth management, you only pay your advisor when you make money. The advisor receives 10 to 20% of your earnings when you make money. What? You make 10%, they take one of it, or 2% of that. You make 20%, they take 2 or 4%. The advisor, though, receives nothing when you lose money or you don't make any money. So every quarter, they have a new high mark, and if you go below that, you don't get charged. But if you go above that, they take 10% of it, or 20%. Currently, or used to be, marketed to high net worth investors. And there's a company up in Del Mar called Dunham & Associates. And I saw this, it was 2006, right? 2006 or 7? When I saw the presentation, I said, you know what? They're going to get really screwed in the next bear market. Because they're not charging anything when the markets go down. How do they pull that off? Well, now they lower their fees to much less than they charge when they're making money. When there's a bear market, obviously they had to survive the bear market because for 4 or 5 years they didn't make any money. How do you pay the rent? How do you pay the mortgage? So it sounds tempting, right? You don't make it. If you make money, your advisor makes money. Fine. And if I lose money, my advisor doesn't make any money. Doesn't that sound tempting? No. Okay. Good. Because the reality is, you could wind up spending a whole lot more money on your services than just paying the stupid commission and being done with it. Right? That's my humble opinion. I'm old school. But not anymore. I'm a bit of a dinosaur in this case. Because now you'll see more and more companies going towards this performance base. And have you heard about the robo-advisors? Have you heard about robotic advisors now? It's an algorithm? Nod your head yes or go no. You never heard him? Okay. I just think it's total BS. And so I don't do enough. I don't do enough to stay with it because I want nothing to do with it. If this is the new normal, I don't want anything to do with it. Well, let me show you. A client comes to me, got a good referral, folks. Referrals are the best. And she doesn't really understand what Fidelity's doing to her because the advisor she had left, and now she's got a new. Oh my God! This is not supposed to be seeing this one. Where the hell is the? Oh my! I'm in trouble. Don't call FINRA, okay, guys? Do me a favor. Don't call the feds. I'm in trouble. Where the hell is the one I scanned? I must have left that out in the car. Okay. Okay, well, anyway, I have it. I do with it? My apologies, I got the wrong... You're not supposed to be seeing this either. Mute that. Why didn't I put it in time? Yeah, that's the wrong one. We don't want you to see that one. Because that has all the account numbers and all the good stuff on there. My apologies. I got it in the I'll be right back. Isn't it a good idea that I'm retiring? This is what happens when you get old. I guess it happens to you before you get old. I'll be right back. Somebody tell a bad joke. Or a good joke. Somebody tell a good joke. Kathleen. Tell them a good joke. A bad joke. Sorry about that. But as I was saying, referrals out in the industry are your best advertising. So do right by your clients, even if it's only a $50, $25 a month client. And then, oops. Okay, great. So, yeah. So do you see an account number? Do you see a name? No. Now this person is in their 50s. And she has a disability, so she can't work anymore. But she has a sizable account. Some of it she inherited, but most of it was something, you know, she put money into an IRA, put money in her 401k, and she's professional, but she can't work anymore. So this is it. You know, she has to live off of this for the rest of her life. She hasn't gotten... So later on, she'll be able to get Social Security, and that will certainly help. But is that a pretty good nest egg? Yeah. Think she can live off of that? Mm-hmm. By the way, she has paid off her house, too. So she took business 121 30 years ago. Good for her. She's paying down debt, saving away, didn't spend every dime she had. So that's business 121. All right, so she says, yeah, I don't really know what I signed up for with this new advisor. But it doesn't look right. First of all, you get a quarterly statement, or actually this is a monthly statement, and it's 44 pages. Something should, alarm bell should go off. You know, you say, that's not right. Something's not right here. And so I'm trying to go through this. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to show you the robo-advisor. I'm assuming, I didn't ask too many questions. I just explained, what the hell is going on here? And it's, I'm like 8 pages of this. It just seems like they're buying and selling willy-nilly. You sold in 3 shares at 217. And you got 233. The transaction cost, your profit was $16.36. You sold. The transaction cost was a penny. $2.29 profit. You sold. 56-cent loss. Well, she's... What the hell's going on, right? It's obviously a computer doing this. People don't do this. You know, they don't have somebody sitting down and typing in these transactions. And she's getting, you know, charged 1 cent, 2 cents, 1 cent, 2 cents. She's getting charged assets under management for this account. It's not the only account. She has a few accounts, but for this account, which is about, you know, $200,000. Here is the asset. At least Fidelity puts it on the front page. Whereas Wells Fargo, they put it on the end. She's getting charged so far that year, and she'd only had it for a few months. She only had it for a few months. She so far was charged $704 for the management fee. See what's going on? Does she really understand what's going on? Do I understand what's going on? If this is robo-advising, I want nothing to do with it. Because that's not investing. That's just having a computer buy and sell and buy and sell. And there's 8 pages of this stuff, folks. 8 pages of spies and sell orders. Here, let's take a look at this one. Johnson & Johnson. That's a stock you hold forever, right? They bought it. What? Their cost was $3.58, and they sold it for $3.92, so they made a $33 profit. Yippee! This is ridiculous. Do you agree with me, or do you think, oh, this is cool? I like to have the computer doing this, inking out little bitty gains or little bitty losses. That's not investing. To me, it's not investing. So if this is the new robo-advising, computerized trading, I don't want anything to do with it. But there's, like I said, there's more. Oh, here's the company. Did you hear this company, Potash Corporation of Saskatchewan? They had the symbol POT. Oh, you can't see that, can you? Tell me if you can see it or not. Whoa, stop. It gets stuck in it. Me and technology don't get along very well, dude. You just notice that? I'm still waiting for that internet fad to blow over. Okay, focus. Here's the company, Potash Corporation of Saskatchewan. What do they make? Manure. Fertilizer. They make poop, right? Well, they take it and turn it into fertilizer. Their symbol was POT. Pot. So they sold that. They had an auction to sell that symbol to one of the marijuana companies, and they paid. I forget how much money they paid for it. They said, we got this valuable asset, our symbol. We don't give a crap about it, but somebody else does, so we'll sell it. But do you see what I'm saying? This is what you're up against. This is what these three-piece suits are going to try to sell you. They're going to try to sell you these robo-advisor services where you buy and sell without even sitting. You're sitting in at home, sleeping. The computer is buying and selling for you. And that's what they're pushing these days. What do you think? Is that what you want? No? Neither do I. But, hey, it's your money. So let's get back to the presentation. Oops. Back to slide 7. Now, do you really need to use a brokerage firm? Do you? Oops. Back to the computer. Do you really need to use the computer? Do you really need to use a brokerage firm? And the answer is no. If you're a long-term, I'm going to pass this back to Nick. If you're a long-term oriented investor who's buying for you know, 3 to 5, 10 or 20 more years, then you can go the dividend reinvestment plan. Most of the large, well-established companies offer their own DRIPs. We saw San Diego Gas and Electric, where you go directly to the company. Well, they're not doing it. Somebody's doing it for them. And you buy and sell through them, and the fees are outrageously low. Some companies will allow you to aggregate your DRIPs together. There's an organization called betterinvesting.org. It's the National Association of Investors Corp. These are the people who sponsored the investment clubs, not our investment club. Well, by the way, today we have somebody from Franklin Templeton. He's been in the business a long time, pretty sharp. John Lundy here at noon. And so they had their own system, and now they use another company called Folio FN. I think they charge $10 a month. $10 a month to aggregate all your dividend reinvestment plans. That's dirt cheap, folks. It's really cheap. But if you don't even want to spend that, you can have 18 DRIPs from 18 different companies. You have to deal with 18 different statements. It's all electronic now, so what do you care? Cool? So where are you going to put your money? Who with? We already have 6 people with Robinhood. Anybody have any other brokerage firms? Acorns. I know someone's been telling me about Acorns, too.
It's basically like a mutual fund where you could either donate to it monthly or through your transactions, they round it up to the nearest $5.
And the acorns supposed to grow and become trees. Right?
Yeah, and it sounds like they're breaking it down. Like,
okay. I have to really look into these things. What?
Yeah.
Cheap.
But it's $2 a month.
$1 or $2 a month. They're using technology. Is it really $1 or $2 a month, though? You understand that you're not getting the best price, but who cares? So you add an extra 10 cents or dollar or whatever to the transaction cost. Big deal. You buy 10 shares and they charge you 5 cents more. That's 50 cents. So it's not a big deal. Cool. Okay. So now, all right. We've got to get our thinking cap on because here too, we did futures and options on Tuesday, and that looks pretty scary and something that is tough in the Series 7. And now we're going to do margins and shorting. A cash account. A cash account is a brokerage account in which all transactions are made on a strictly cash basis. They're the simplest arrangements. There's no credit check of the customer by the brokerage firm. Once you've established a good relationship, most brokerage firms will allow you to purchase shares of a stock even if you don't have enough cash in the account. Why? Well, do you remember that stock transactions close in 3 days? You make the transaction today, you have 3 days to get the money in the account. Most of the deep discount brokers are not going to allow this. If the money's not in your account, they just say, you can't buy it. And as soon as you buy it, even though it's not going to happen until 3 days, they say no more. They assume that money has already been spent. You with me? Understand? And Robinhood, the money has to be in your account, right? They don't give you 3 days to... Yeah, they don't give you 3 days to get the money in there. Okay, but we do. I mean, we know who you are. You're not going to screw us. We'll let you buy shares and get the money in the account within 3 days. Okay, that's the cash account. The other type of account, and the one that Carlos was making refer to that maybe Robinhood has, because as of last year, the last time I was reading about them, when they were pulling that stunt where they said, we're going to offer checking accounts with paying interest. No, you're not. You're not a bank. The Federal Reserve is not going to allow you to do that. FINRA is not going to allow you to do that. SEC is not going to allow you to do that. Within a day, they said, oh, no, we're not going to do it. No, we're not going to do it. So a margin account is a brokerage account in which, subject to limitations, you can buy stocks, bonds, maybe mostly stocks, on credit. Your brokerage firm will offer you credit terms. The brokerage firm is going to do a credit check to determine your credit worthiness because you're going to be borrowing money from them. So they're going to do basically what a bank would do, what a credit card company would do. They're going to see what your credit score is and whether they're going to ask how much money you make. We're supposed to ask that anyway. When a client opens up an account, you're going to ask how much their annual salary is, what are their assets, other types of things. You're supposed to know your client. And I always say, in the biblical sense, you want to know your client. That's a joke. You guys don't know the biblical sense of knowing? You didn't know? He knew her?
Yeah.
Yeah, he knows. It's basically a biblical way of saying he screwed her. He knew her. You know, in Genesis, where the two women, the sisters, get their father dead drunk. And then... You guys got to read the Bible. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in there. Because the tribe is getting really low, and so the sisters go, we need... And they say, stop. It's Bible. What are you talking about? I'm just quoting from the Bible. I mean, isn't it called the good book? Right? You guys got to read it. You'd be surprised what's in there. Okay, now, the interest rate you pay on the money borrowed from your broker is called the margin rate. And it's actually a very good rate. It's a whole lot better than a credit card. It's about 1 or 2 percentage points or over prime or about 2 or 3 above the money market rates. So assuming that money market is now about 2% and prime is about what? 3 or something? You're going to be paying 6%, 5-6%, which isn't bad. You know, what is your credit card charging you?
12 to 21
or more. So it's actually not a bad rate. The margin rate that we pay to our brokers to allow us to borrow money to buy stocks. A margin account allows you to perform margin trading, or what I usually say is buying on margin, which still people don't really understand what it means, but it's still very simple. You're borrowing money to purchase securities. Remember, we haven't done the real estate yet. We'll do the real estate next week. But that magnifies your returns by reducing the amount of equity that the investor must put up. If it magnifies your returns on the way up, what's it doing on the way down? Magnifying your losses, right. And sometimes called leveraged account. There's that word leverage, using other people's money to make your money. The margin, which I don't really like this, the margin is the amount that you put up. That's the part that's not borrowed. Shouldn't it be the other way around? Shouldn't the margin be the part that you didn't put up? No, the margin is how much you put up. So, for example, you might have put up 75% you brought to the table. That's the margin. And then the borrowed part that the brokerage firm would create is the 25%. That's the borrowed amount. The margin is the amount that you have brought to the table. Questions? Okay. Now, buying on margin allows the investor to use financial leverage. The use of debt financing the margin to magnify your investment returns. It also allows an investor to tap into the equity in their account. Now, this is the reason that if I ever do, this is why I would use myself, Frank Pagnano, buying on margin. Because you don't want to sell your shares. They're cool shares. You're in it for the long term, but you need some cash. So just as you can borrow money from your house on a home equity line of credit, it's the same idea. We can borrow money based on the value of our stocks. We don't have to sell the stocks because we don't want to sell the stocks. We're happy with the stocks, but we need some cash, so we borrow from our stocks. And then with the idea that eventually we're going to pay it back, right? That would be the only reason I would ever buy on margin. But other people buy on margin to increase their financial leverage, to juice the returns, to make the return, magnify the returns. But as we said, you can magnify your losses. Now, buying on margin is much like buying a house or home equity line of credit. But when you buy a house, how much do you have to come up with? 10, 20%. They'd love you to come up with 20%. If you're a first-time home buyer, 3 or 5%?
1%.
What?
I've heard 1%.
1%, that's tough to find. But you can find it. 3% is the FHA. If you're a first-time home buyer, they want you. There are programs to help you. And you come up with, now you're going to pay more. You're going to pay a higher interest rate. You're going to pay what's called private mortgage insurance. But at least you got a home, right? But not with stocks. Stocks require at least 50% down. So you cannot borrow more than 50% of the value of the stocks. Now that's set by the Federal Reserve Bank. Not the SEC. The Federal Reserve Bank sets that rate. It's been 50% for decades, but they could always change it at any time. The margin requirement, also often called the initial margin, is how much you have to come up with, also called the initial margin. Now, as we said, the Federal Reserve Bank sets it at 50%. But your brokerage firm can say, no, no, you have to come up with more. They have the discretion. They can't make it less, but they can say, you know what, you need to come up with 75%. Because they're supposed to be looking at your financial situation and deciding whether or not you can, you know, do the transaction. And then the margin loan, also called the debit balance, is the amount that you have borrowed. So that's the borrowed amount there. I need a new crayon. This is brilliant. Any other crayons? How about this guy? Yeah, not very good. Yeah, I've been I'm a short timer, they call us. It's not cheap. I'm not. Okay, so now, here's an example. All right, now, let's say you bought a stock for $20. Same thing that we saw on Tuesday, right? And that stock goes to $30. Cool. What was your return on investment? The absolute dollar return is $10. And how much did you bring to the table? $20, so what did you get? 50%. Pretty good. If you go to your broker and say, I'd like a margin account, your broker says, yeah, okay, your initial margin is 50%. So you have a 50% margin. You can come up with $10. And, well, I should put this here. Yours. This is yours. Margin. And then the margin balance of the debit loan, the amount you borrowed, is $10. So you came up with $10, but you're able to buy a $20 stock. Now if the stock goes up $10 to $30, what's your absolute dollar return? $10. Your absolute dollar return is still $10. But how much did you put up? $10. Only $10. Now what's your return? You see how it magnified your return? Is that cool? Until, what happened? Until you got to pay it back. You got to pay it back. And they're charging you interest. So congratulations. You made $10 on a $10 investment. This is half of what you had to come up with when you simply purchase a stock outright with your own money. Instead of a 50% return on your investment, you received a 100% return on your investment. Let's look at it again. This time, you borrowed $10. You put up $10. You purchased one share of stock for $10. $20, I'm sorry. But this time, the stock price goes down to $10. What happened? If it were a cash account and you had come up with $20, you've now lost $10 on a $20 investment. You've lost 50%. But remember, all this money was borrowed. You've lost everything. You've lost 100% because you got to pay it back. Now you only have a $10 stock. Are you with me? And you put up $10, but you still owe the brokerage firm $10. Oops, only half of the money was yours. You borrowed the rest. You've lost 100%. So you see, it magnifies your returns on the way up, magnifies your losses on the way down. Buying on margin, margin buying was one of the major contributing forces to the crash of 1929. Why? Because they got this new mindset. Oh, stocks are like houses. And you only put 10, 20% down for a house. Why not just put 10, 20% down for a stock? Because real estate is not stocks. Real estate very rarely goes down 10, 20%. It does. In 2008, it went down 50%. And you have to go back to the Great Depression to see that kind of drop in real estate happen. But stocks drop 50%. No big deal. So you think about it. You put up $10, bought a $100 stock, and now the price has plummeted to $40. You lost your $10, and now you still owe $50 to the brokerage firm. Are you with me? You see what's going on? So it's very dangerous. Am I trying to tell you this so you'll do it? No. Instruction about syphilis is not an instruction to get syphilis. But you need to understand it. If only to try to dissuade your friends, family, co-workers at work who are really excited. This guy said I can borrow money from my brokers and I can make a lot more money. Well, yeah, but you can also lose a lot more money. So you will be the voice of reason. Because margin trading is inherently more risky, margin accounts are more highly scrutinized by brokerage firms. Let's use red for this. A restricted account is an account where the margin now is less than the initial margin requirement. The investor may not make any further margin purchases, and before they do anything else, they must bring their margin back to the initial margin requirements when the securities are sold. So they're stuck. If you have a restricted account, you can't make any more. Okay. Where you been? Have a seat. Contact me. Keep in touch. Here's seats over here. Over here. So if your account becomes restricted, you're now below the 50%. You can't do anything else until you bring it back up. You either have to sell the shares or bring up more cash. Information technology has made the brokerage firm's job of scrutinizing margin accounts much easier. Now the computer spits out a list of customers that are restricted. The maintenance margin, it should be blue. The maintenance margin is the absolute minimum amount of equity that a investor must maintain. So the maintenance margin is the absolute minimum. It must be no less than 25%. But your brokerage firm can say for you it's 30% or 45%. If it goes below that, you are going to get what's called a margin call. Margin call. And I don't know if you remember, but the guy in the video we saw, he said margin calls were being sent all throughout the industry. In other words, you're in deep kimchi. This is not allowed. Before this happened, you would get a margin call. They would say, look, you're losing too much money. You got two choices. You either let us sell the stock right now and take your loss, or bring more cash in. Because we're not going to let you lose 100%. Because what happens if they lose even more than that? Yeah, right. The brokerage firm is basically backing you up. So if you keep losing money, and you say, thank you, goodbye, I'm taking off, now the brokerage firm has to deal with the issue. So they're going to watch you very carefully. And some of the deep discount brokers will not wait the 72 hours. Once you get a margin call, if you don't meet that margin call, which is typically 3 days, 72 hours, they are authorized. You sign that when you signed, or now click here, when you signed the broker-client agreement, you agreed that if they believe that you're in deep trouble and you're not contacting them in enough time, they can do it. They can sell the shares and you lose before you even contact them. And this is what the TD Waterhouses, TD Ameritrade now, the Scottrades were doing to people during the tech meltdown of 2000 to 2002. They were not even waiting. They were just going ahead and selling the shares at a loss because they didn't want it. Schwab had a high-stakes gambler in the, I'm not sure where exactly, but supposedly he was in Asia somewhere. And it was tens of millions of dollars this guy lost. And Schwab let him do it. They let him lose his money. Now, I don't know what the disposition of that was, but you know, somebody took a bath. So there's a phrase out in the industry, never meet a margin call. What does that mean? Don't bring more money to the table. Don't throw good money after bad. They're basically saying, you screwed up, you bet, you lost, sell it now, be done with it. Although you can bring more cash to the table and lose more money. Okay. Of course, if your investments do very well, then you can use the excess margin you create in your margin account to purchase additional stock without having to come up with more money. It's called excess margin. You have done well. It's gone up. Now you have more money you can play with, even though you haven't come up to the table. You can buy more shares, and that's called pyramiding. The technique of using excess margin from paper profits in margin accounts to partly or fully finance the acquisition of additional securities. What do you think of that?
Is it like the concept of drips?
Well, no, drips are dividend reinvestment plans, and I have never seen a margin. Well, actually, I think some brokerage firms will let you do drips with dividend reinvestment plans in the brokerage account, and they're not going to let you do margining. But the ones that you go through where you go to, you know, Coca-Cola, look, investor relations, and here's our dividend reinvestment plan, no, they're not margin accounts, no. They're just, yeah.
I was wondering if it's like the concept of it, where if they do really well, like they'll be put back into it.
Well, The cash builds up in your account. So you can do what they call pyramiding and buy more shares with that cash, even though, you know, you haven't come up with that cash. It's a paper profit, so to speak. What do you think it is?
Bad idea.
I think so too. It's up to you, you decide. But basically you're just making your empire that much bigger based on debt, and if the market turns against you, your investments turn out to be not so good, you can get screwed. Now, margin trading also includes paying interest on the margin. You're not getting it for free, folks. You're paying interest on the margin loan. It adds yet another drag on your investment returns. Your margin investments must meet or exceed the margin interest rate in order for you to just break even. And now you know why your broker is so happy to take your calls. Because you're paying them commissions or maybe assets under management, and you're paying them interest. Something you want to do? Yes? No? You're real quiet today. Yeah?
Thursday?
Is that what it is? Well, so why should I buy on margin? And the easy answer is, for me, don't do it. You shouldn't. The risks are not worth the potential reward, in my humble opinion. But again, it ain't my money. So you decide. However, there is a valid, logical reason for having a margin account. As we said, a margin account allows you to temporarily borrow from your investments without having to sell them. Because if you sell them, not only have to pay the commissions, but more importantly, you're going to generate taxable transactions. You see? And you may not want to do that, or maybe you do. You know, it's up to you. But the borrowing from your investments allows you to take out the cash temporarily, use it for whatever you need, and then put it back in, not generating commissions and not generating taxable transactions. Yes?
So you use it for long-term investments, like buying cheap stock and then paying back the 50%, but then keeping the stock for like another 50 years?
That's what I would do. That's what I would do. If you need the money, if you need the money for the short term, where you keep your long-term investments intact, you don't have to sell them, you're really happy with Exxon, you've had it for decades or whatever, and you don't want to sell it, so you can hang on to the shares of the stock, borrow from them, but then think about paying it back, right? And just hope that the market doesn't melt down. Questions, thoughts? Now, on the Series 7 are questions that you have to go through and do the different examples, and then there's, you know, four choices that you have to choose from. Now, we have a worksheet, as we did on, we didn't take a look at the worksheet on Tuesday, but we have a worksheet that if we had more time, we'd go through, but I gave you the answer keys, so if I'm going to print it out, I might as well print out the answer keys. This is not going to be on the exam, you understand? No exam, there's nothing, but it is on the Series 7. And again, these are some of the trickier parts of the Series 7, these questions, because you can zig when you should have zagged. Did you get the stock options from Tuesday? No, okay. If you didn't get the Tuesday stock options and futures, contact me after class, okay? All right, so we're not going to do these, but they are tricky. Because, now again, I took the Series 7 20 years ago, so I don't know if they still ask you to do the balance sheet. You accounting fans will know that this looks like a balance sheet, assets, liabilities, and account equity, and you have to play the game. You have to add to certain accounts, subtract. Don't worry, there's no journal entries. And so I'm not going to deal with that. But you can. And if you do take the Series 7, if you do get a job in the industry and decide that you're going to eventually become a broker, WonderProfessor.com will still be up. Please contact me. And your brokerage firm is going to give you plenty of materials. There's all kinds of online materials that you can buy or just play with. So we'll help you. We'll help you get through it. It's not impossible. It ain't easy. It's not easy to exam, but it's not impossible. Now, you're going to love this. And boy, is this really timely. Because buying on margin, you know, I wouldn't recommend people doing it. But again, as Marco said, we got something that we had long term. We need some cash. We'll borrow from it. What about shorting? Buying, selling short, going short. Long purchases, buying long, going long. These are transactions in which investors buy securities in the hope that they will increase in value and can be sold at a later date for profit. Have you heard of buy low, sell high? Right? That's what we think of when we think of stocks. We want to buy something low, we want to sell high. And this is the type of transaction that people commonly think of when they hear that someone bought stocks. Buying long is the most common form of transaction. Expectations of dividends or capital appreciation or both, right? buy low, sell high. Now, so if we have a long purchase, so we're going to get rid of the margining here. We're going to get rid of the margining here. We buy a share of stock for $20, and the market value rises to $30. Call. We made 50%. If the price dropped to $10, you lost 50%. Are you with me? That's straightforward, isn't it? Now, selling short is the exact opposite, and it drives people nuts. The first time I heard it, and I don't think I'm alone. Is that legal? Can you do this? Oh yeah, it's legal. Selling short, shorting the stock, going short. The sale of borrowed securities, their eventual repurchase from the short seller, and their return to the lender. What you want to do is you want to sell high and then buy low. So it's the same idea, except you do it in reverse. Now, where do you get the shares? How do you sell shares that you don't have? You borrow them from somebody. You borrow them from another investor. Now, do they know that you borrowed them? Borrowed the shares from them? No. The brokerage firm takes care of all that. So they literally will go to another investor that they have in their clientele, and if you wanted to short 100 shares of IBM, they would find somebody who's got 100 shares of IBM, and they'd sell those shares. Now, you, if you're the owner of the IBM shares, you never know this. You don't know that. They don't call, tell you, somebody, hey, we sold your shares. They take care of, the brokerage firm takes care of all the back office stuff. Doesn't that sound illegal? What do you think the bank does with your money when you put it in the savings account?
Loan it out.
They loan it out, right? So it's not illegal. It's perfectly legit. Doesn't sound legal to me, but I'm not in charge of the situation. You are hoping that the price goes down. Selling short must take place in a margin account. So before you can sell short, you have to open up a margin account. Why? Because instead of borrowing cash, you're borrowing stock. You see the same idea? You're still borrowing from them. So they're going to check to make sure that you have a good credit history, that you're reliable, and you're not going to run out on them. Here's how it works. You borrow the stock from another shareholder. You have this idea that IBM is going to go down. You think they're run terribly. I can't stand that company. They're going to go down. So you say, I want to short 100 shares. You borrow the stock from another shareholder without their knowledge. You sell it on the market. You receive money for selling stock that you do not own. Cash comes into your account. You wait for the stock price to go down. You then buy back the shares at a lower price, pocketing the difference. And the example I used back in Chapter 5 when we just mentioned this is you have two neighbors. One just bought this riding low mower for $500, and you know it tomorrow is going to go on sale for $250. You can borrow it from the guy that you borrow, next door neighbor. Can I borrow that? Then you drive it over to the guy over there. Hey, you want to buy this for $500? Oh, yeah, I was just about to go buy one. And then the next day, it goes on sale. You buy it back, bring it back to the first guy. Doesn't sound legal, does it? Perfectly legal in the world of stocks. The shareholder you borrowed the shares from never knows that the shares were borrowed. The brokerage firm does all the financial sleight of hand. By the way, if that stock has dividends, you, the short seller, has to pay those dividends. Because now the shares are gone, right? They're in the person's, they see them in their statement. I still have 100 shares of IBM, and IBM just paid me a dividend, so I better get that dividend, right? But IBM didn't pay the dividend to that person because those shares are somewhere else. They paid the dividend to somebody else. So now you have to pay those dividends as the short seller. Yeah, I don't like it either. Okay. Doesn't it sound like it should be illegal? No, it's not illegal. So here's how it works. Buy the shares from someone, sell the shares in the marketplace. Then the price goes down, you buy the shares back from the market, and then return the shares. If the price goes down, you've made money. If the price goes up, you've lost money. It's the opposite of buying long. So let's do the same example here. The long purchase, you bought the shares for $20 a share. They went up to 30. You sold them. You made 10 bucks. Now, if it's a short sale, we're hoping that the price goes down. So we buy it for $20 a share. We receive $20 from the sale of the stock, even though the stock was not yours. You borrowed it from somebody and sold it. Now let's say the price goes down to $10. You buy it back at 10 bucks, and this is the term they use, close out the transaction. You give the stock back to the person you borrowed it from, and you get to keep 10 bucks. You made $10 on a $0 investment. Does that sound legit? Can you make $10 on a $0 investment? No. No, you can't. No, it doesn't work that way. You cannot really make $10 on a $0 investment. It's a margin account, remember? You borrowed the stock that you sold. The rules for a margin account still apply. You must put up at least 50%. 50% of what? I borrowed the stuff. Well, you must put 50% of what you borrowed. 50% of the proceeds from the sale of the borrowed stock you have to come up with. You borrowed the stock that you sold, so you have to borrow, you have to come up with 50% of what you sold. Again, the brokerages use the account balance sheets to keep track of the investor's margin. Now, let's say we'll look at them real quickly. You sell the stock for 20 bucks. You receive $20 from the sale of the stock. Even though the stock was not yours, you borrowed it from someone else. What happens if the price now goes up to 40? You got to buy it back at 40. You see what's happening? It's a mirror. Whereas we're usually excited. Wow, the price went up to 40. We made, you know, but we shorted. We were hoping it would go down. Now we got $20 from the when we sold it. Now we got to pay 40 bucks for it. You understand what's going on? Are you going to do it? Thank you. Peter Lynch says never short a stock. And who am I to argue with Peter Lynch? He only racked up 29% a year for 12 years. Yes?
So if the original stock price was 20 and on the margin account, you'd have to pay 10 for it, right? So you're basically $10 in the hole, and then if it shoots up to 40, do you get credit for the $20 value of the stock, or are you just paying 40 bucks?
Well, you got 20 bucks. You got $20 from the sale of the
stock. From the original share.
You got $20, so you got $20 in your account, okay. Plus the $10 you have to come up with. And so now you have to buy it back for 40.
Okay, so you're starting off basically $10 positive, but then if it goes to 40, you have to buy it back, so you lost 30 bucks.
That basically, yeah. Yeah, that's what happens. So when you buy long, you can only lose the purchase price of the stock. You buy the stock for 20 bucks, it goes to zero, you lost 20 bucks. Yeah, I'm sorry, Marco, sorry.
Oh, so if you're really feeling speculative, you could buy, you could sell short and you could doing options for
puts, price for right? Yeah. And then if it goes up, well, the puts, you don't, you're going to just going to lose the price of the puts, right? If the option turns against you, you just lose the premium that you paid. So say it was $2 or $1, that's all you lost. But in the case of the short, there's no limit. There is theoretically no limit to how much you can lose. Because once the stock goes to zero, it can't go any lower. But is there any limit to how high it can go? Is there a stop sign? Okay, it's $100, can't go any higher. And so, yes?
The brokerage has its own stop sign, though, right?
Yes, exactly. The margin, right. This is not going to be allowed. Just like we had the margin requirement when we margined, bought on margin, there's a margin requirement for how much you can lose when you sell short. However, what if the stock explodes? The brokerage firm won't have time. And I think I showed you this once. I'm going to show it to you again.
Oh, yeah,
I showed it to you, didn't I? You remember the guy? Do you remember him? Help! Help! Where is he?
Do you
want
to go back again after that? You say
he's
going to do it again?
Oh, I don't know. I think, that was the options guy. Here is the short. This is the guy who shorted his stock. He shorted his stock, KBIO, and overnight, so the brokerage firm didn't have any time to deal with it. Overnight, the stock exploded.
Holy shit.
He lost $106,000 overnight.
Yeah,
Yeah, and he started like, he wanted like a Kickstarter or something?
Yeah, this was the guy who, this is the guy who wanted to help GoFundMe, right?
Yeah, still using other people's money.
He might end up liquidating his 401k and his wife's hopes you will hopes you will come in and he actually got $5,000, right? Okay. I was holding KBOI short overnight for what I thought was a nice $2 fade coming. It means he thought it was going to drop $2. At the close of the bell, I saw the quote montage clear out and figured today there was no action after hours in the stock. So I went to my office for a long meeting. I got out of the meeting and saw a message from one of my buddies asking if I was okay since I was short KBOI. He was not okay. Exploded, running up 800%. It was winding down operations. It was running out of cash. It was developing two potential cancer drugs. But somebody threw in some money. So what happened? The day before, he had 33,000, basically, after everything is all said and done. And then the next day, he owed him $106,000. Now, what if he walks away? Who's screwed? E-Trade. But he's not going to do that. He says he's not going to do it. And now he wants you to donate to him. And do you think people donated? Some people did. What was it? Some people put in $5,300. $5,300. But they were not happy. Look, oh, so you lost a lot of money. Would you contribute to bail out some other trader who was stuck in the same picture? Homeless, need money. Well, I'm sure when you purchased all those shorts at the expense of the longs, in other words, you were trying to make the stock go down, you were not worried about the money they were losing. Pay your dues and move on. And then, man, you should save those gophers. What? Which is our top message. You can suck. I know. You can suck it. I like this one. You request for your divorce fees, not E-Trade. What's the most important? In 121, we talk about the most important financial decision you'll ever make.
Getting married.
Getting married, right. Some people can tell you. So there's a saying in the short world. Now this is before women got involved, but he who sells what isn't his'n must buy it back or go to prison. Now we don't have debtors' prisons anymore, but cute, isn't it? In other words, you do this, you are really putting yourself at risk and can lose a tremendous sum of money. The only stock I ever wanted to short was in 2005 and 6, GM, because I kept saying no. GM is going down. They are going down. I was right, but I didn't short it. I didn't short them, and I didn't do it. So I've never shorted. And then we go through this is what's going to be on the Series 7. I'm not sure if they still use the old accounting method. I assume they do because it's all computerized now, and obviously they can't expect you to learn something like QuickBooks on the Series 7. So anyway, part of when you get into investing, you're going to learn this, folks. It's going to happen to you. You're going to see these precipitous days where the market is just boom, it just falls like that, like the last couple of days. Why has it fallen so far? Right, because of Mr. Putin. What's his name? It's Trump? Pinche Trump? He is now saying, no deal with China. I know. Now you understand shorting? He's got maybe his son, maybe some other person. He said, short stocks. We're going to blow the deal. Short the stocks. Because that's the kind of guy he is, right? Everything's about himself. He doesn't care about anybody else. He has no soul. He has no conscience. So he's making money off of being the president, which is forbidden, but he's doing it because he doesn't care. Okay. We'll see what happens next year. When the market falls precipitously, there's a lot of short selling going on. Just as when the market goes up, there's a lot of long buying going on because people are getting euphoric and people are getting very frightened. So momentum traders will short stocks to push the market down even further. But I like to think of it like a spring. You press down on the spring. Remember, they all have to be bought back, right? What happens? It blows up in your face. So people get to, did you see the market fell 2-3%? He's like, just wait a few days. And then, boom, it jumps back up again. You go, why is that happening? Well, there's speculators, traders. And if they're buying this, I'm selling short, what do they got to do? They got to buy it back. And that's called a short squeeze. And so the market pushes, the shorting pushes the market down. The shorts have to buy them back. And then, boom, you have a dramatic rebound. And did we take a look at short interest? We'll take a look at short interest. Short interest is the amount of shares that are sold short. So let's take a look at it. What stock do you think is the stock that people will want to short? Stock you think has gone down? Tesla, anyone? No stocks you don't think are going to go down? Oil stocks? Okay, let's take a look at ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil. I like Chevron a little better, but hey, I'm almost good. Okay, so now, what you do is you go to key statistics, or just statistics now. And on the right-hand side, tells you how many shares are outstanding, only 4.23 billion, but there's only 36 million shares short, which is less than 1%. So our investors, or speculators, traders, triculators, speculators, do they think that Exxon's going down? They don't agree with Kathleen. No, they don't agree with
the oil from the WFT.
What?
WFT Weatherford.
Who is that?
Oil firm.
An oil firm? WFT? Let's take a look at them. WFT. Oh, Weatherford. I'm sorry, Weatherford. I'm sorry, I didn't quite. So let's take a look at them. They have 1 billion shares outstanding and 10%, over 10%. Right. So, yeah, people are thinking that these people are going to go down. Because, look, there's a billion shares outstanding. Where did it go? There. Float is almost a billion, right? That number is probably something different. But over 100 million shares are short. And that's over 11%. And it's up from a month ago where it was 10%. So short sellers are pushing down the price of this company. Now, eventually, two things are going to happen. The stock's going to collapse, in which case the short sellers have won. But if it ever starts turning upward, what are the short sellers going to do?
They're going to get out.
They got to get out. They got to buy it back. Are you with me? Make sense?
Doesn't that accelerate it, though, too?
That should accelerate it. That's called a short squeeze. Okay. It should accelerate it. But if Weatherford falls into the porcelain oasis, and then the short sellers don't care because they can buy it back at pennies, if it becomes a penny stock. Are you with me? Yeah, okay, good. Don't do it. All right. Now, I was living through my first major. Well, no, I lived through 87, but I didn't have much at all then. But I've been a broker for about 5 years or so, and I was going, when's this going to end? And in August of 2002, short interest on the New York Stock Exchange was the highest it had ever been in the history of the United States stock markets. And I thought, okay, we're near the end. And then I heard somebody who I really trusted say, yeah, we're near the end. And it turns out the bottom was October. So when you see the short interest become absolutely outrageous, unless the world ends. If the world ends, it doesn't matter, okay? It just doesn't matter where we put our money. But if you see short interest dramatically high, then the end is near. Actually, there used to be a valid reason for shorting a stock. There used to be, not anymore. The IRS stopped it. Let's say it's December, and you want to sell these shares. Well, if you sell the shares in December, it's going to be reported as a taxable transaction in that year. So by April, you have to pay the tax. You could short those shares, even though you own them. You have 100 shares of whatever company. You could short that stock, even though you use the shares, and then wait until January, and then return the shares, basically. Just say, hey, don't go out and buy the shares. Here's the 100 shares that I shorted. You return the shares. You see what you just did? You took the gain and moved it to the next tax year. So you don't have to worry about the taxes for another year. IRS says no. They closed that loophole in 1997. So my advice is there's never a reason for you to short a stock. Just don't do it. Peter Lynch says don't short a stock. That's good enough for me. Now, last time, I'm going to, maybe I'll do it next week too. Who's interested in getting in the industry? Just a few, almost, hopefully. There's a future for you folks. I'm serious. They need more women, bilingual, ex-military, minorities. They have a whole bunch of old folks like me getting ready to retire. What? A follow-up. What is the follow-up?
You asked the question. I'm wondering if it was a follow-up.
What question did I ask?
Again.
I did. Okay, so the follow-up is, there's a future for you. There's a future for you, folks. I mean, it doesn't have to be in stocks, although the Series 7 is the gold standard, right? If you go insurance, they're going to go to Series 6, which is really brain dead easy. That's just about mutual funds. But it's the Series 7 is a difficult test. As we said, I guess I didn't change this slide. SIE now, the Securities Industries, no, SEI. You don't have to take the Series 7 first. If you take the Series 7, you have to be sponsored. But if you take the SEI, Securities Essentials, no, SIE, Securities Essentials Exam? Oh, Securities Industry Essentials, that's it. Securities Industry Essentials. One of the students in the investment club took it. I think it was about 70, 80 bucks you got to come up with. But you don't, because the Series 7 is like $600. And you don't normally pay it. The brokerage firm will pay it for you. Plus, they are sponsoring you. You're already working for them as a broker's aide or whatever. But the brokerage firms don't want to hire somebody until they know they can pass it. Yeah.
When I looked online, it said that you can actually file to take the Series 7 now. And then if you don't have somebody sponsoring you, there's like firms there that will sponsor you. I mean, you got to pay out.
Right. How much do they want? $1,000?
No. I think it was like $300 or something like that. And then they'll sponsor you.
But you have to pay for the test.
Yeah.
So it's about $1,000. Yeah.
Oh, well then, yeah.
Yeah, about $1,000. Yeah. Okay.
But
so
then they will sponsor you. So you
but if you pass this one, they'll come a calling. That's my understanding. I haven't worked any places that are using these. But the Series 7 is difficult. It's 3 hours in the morning, you get an hour for lunch, and then 3 hours in the afternoon. And it starts off, it's 120 questions each 3 hours. It starts off very easy. And the first few questions I thought, oh my, I hope these... Yeah, the first one I think, is this serious? That's the question you're asking me? And then they get harder and harder and harder and harder until in the middle of the test, you really don't know what the hell is this. And they tell you that. They tell you that some of the questions you just won't know. We're just asking these questions. We don't even bother. It's not part of the test. We just ask them for you. And why? I don't know. I don't know why they do that. And then some of the questions were just, they were about the Telephone Act of 1990 or something. Telephone Act. But then it gets easier. So they lift you up, you know, basically stab you, and then on the way down, it gets easier. And the same thing happens in the afternoon. And then after you're done, after you hit the submit button, boom, it comes back. It tells you, yeah, you passed, or no, you didn't pass. And the tough part about it is that there are about 7 or 8 parts of the exam. You don't see them. You just see the questions come in the order they come. But you have to pass every part of the exam with 70%. And the tough parts are buying on margin, shorting, and options. And those are pretty tricky. Because as we saw, it's like a mirror, right? The call option, the put option. The shorting and the margining, they're like mirrors. You buy low, sell high, buy low. So that's the tricky part. But other than that, you can do it. It takes about 2 months, studying 1 to 2 hours a day. You go through the practice exams over and over and over again. You can do it, providing you're remotely sober. People who fail it the first time, and I try to coax it out of them, they really... The parts like options and stuff, they really did not understand it that well, and they just thought they could wing it. The problem is, if you do the call or the put, there'll be two different answers. If you zig one way or zag the other way, and both answers will be the options and choices for the answers. So they got you. You know, if they just put the one right answer, you would get it wrong. Okay, that can't be right because it's not one of the four, but it is one of the four. Questions, thoughts, ideas? And you know PNC Trump is making money off of shorting right now. He's got somebody selling short because he knows that the market was going to crash because he doesn't care. He doesn't give a crap. Questions, thoughts, ideas, comments, criticisms. Okay, now, we are, we don't have time to get started another one. But, actually, let's do one. Let's do a real quick one. How do we have time? Yeah, let's do gold. How many of you, when you took this class, thought you were going to buy gold? Anybody? Did you think gold? I want to buy gold. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. Maybe I got six. Yeah, six slides. Let's burn through this real fast. Don't do it. Go ahead. If you want to buy some gold coins, they look pretty. Where are you going to store them? You'll bury them in the ground somewhere? Hope you don't forget where they buried them. You're going to put them in the safety deposit box at the bank? In plain sight, out so people can see them. Don't put them in the bank. Don't put them in the safety deposit box. Because if you bought gold for the reason that the world is going to fall apart, and the world does fall apart, and you say, I got my gold, you're not going to be able to get inside the bank. There's going to be armed guards in front of the banks. And that gold in the bank is no longer yours. They'll give you cash for it. The government will take it. So don't do it, okay? And I like what Tom Petrino said. If your reason for owning gold has something to do with the end of the world as we know it, shotguns and canned food would probably be more practical investments. Because when does gold... Okay, by the way, we'll look in a minute. But if you're interested in the stocks of the miners, treat it like a stock. The gold stocks, the companies that actually dig it up out of the ground, one part of the world, send it to another part of the world, bury it in the ground and put an armed guard in front of it. They might be good investments. And then there are actual mutual funds that buy gold on your behalf. But how do you know they're actually buying gold and not lead that's been painted gold? You don't know that. Silver. Would you buy silver?
Depends.
Gold isn't really useful for much of anything, folks. It's a great electrical conductor, but there are far more cheaper. Not quite as good, but they're a whole lot cheaper. But in your cell phone, there's a tiny little bit of gold somewhere in parts that are really important. But don't sell your cell phone for the gold, okay? But silver is actually very useful in the industry. Silver is still a big need for silver. What was the biggest use for silver? Anybody know? It's gone now.
Catalytic converters.
That's these guys. Catalytic converters, that's these guys. Film. Some of you are old enough to remember the little yellow boxes said Kodak on them. You remember those? You younger folks, you don't remember them. You do? Okay. Well, no more film, right? Now, these guys, Carlos, these guys actually do have some usage. Palladium, platinum, rhodium. The catalytic converter in your car is often worth a whole lot more than the engine. In fact, there's thieves that will steal your catalytic converter. And now you're screwed. And you go to the dealer and they say, oh, it's $2,500 to replace. So there. Maybe you want to buy that for the coming demand for catalytic converters and battery and fuel cells and stuff like that. But when anybody wants says, I want to buy gold, I show them this. Remember this from chapter 1? When does gold do well? When the world is about to end. 1860s, Civil War, 1930s, fascism, Great Depression, World War II, 1970s when inflation started to take hold, and gold skyrocketed to $800 an ounce.
Also, height of the Cold War.
Height of the Cold War, right. $800 an ounce. And I remember the lines of people going to sell their gold. Like, hey, I'm going to sell my gold. It then went down to $250 an ounce 20 years later. Not quite. 1999, $250 an ounce. And then skyrocketed in the 2000s to 1200 or something like that. What is it, 1300? It hit 1700, but now it's down about 1300, 1200. So what are you doing when you're buying gold? Does it pay dividends? Interest? Rent? Does it find new markets? Create new products? It's pure speculation. It's pure speculation. So you better be good. You better know when to buy, when to sell, when to buy, when to sell. And good luck if you want to buy gold. Now, how about diamonds and rubies and emeralds? You want to buy diamonds and rubies? No, don't buy diamonds. In fact, they're making diamonds now. And they will make diamonds for you. Because what are diamonds made out of?
Carbon.
Carbon. Everyone say carbon. What are diamonds made out of?
Carbon.
What are you made out of?
Carbon.
So, if Aunt Tia Maria passes away, and you get the ashes after she's been incinerated, you can send some of the ashes to one of these companies, and they will turn her into a diamond, and you can wear Tia Maria on your, or Fluffy, your dog, or Fido. You don't believe me, do you? You don't believe me? Okay, he believes me. Well, I didn't say it wasn't weird, but that's what's going on now. You go to these websites and you can send the ashes in, and they will send you back a diamond. Okay, so don't buy diamonds. What else? Somewhere along the line, okay, give me a couple minutes. Somewhere along the line, someone's going to say, "Oh, you're interested in you know what you're talking about investments? The best investment is fine art." Are they right? Yeah. But only for a tiny little bit of the fine art market. And you got to know exactly what you're doing, because mostly what you're doing, and this is the guy who runs Christie's Auctions, don't buy art as an investment. You buy art because of what it, you know, does for you, makes you think, feel, emote, but don't think you're going to hit the big time. You might do it. You might buy that piece that's a Thomas Kincaid that nobody, they had it in their attic, they didn't know what the hell it was, it's worth $40,000, they didn't even know that, they sold to you for $100. But don't bank on it, all right? Same thing is true for Beanie Babies and baseball cards and Barbie dolls and yes.
But for most of the art that's like worth something, don't you have to be exceedingly lucky to buy that stuff?
Yes, or just damn lucky. Find somebody who has something they don't even know what the hell it is, and they'll sell it to you for $500 and it's worth $50,000 or whatever. Yeah, you just got to be really, really wealthy and buy a Picasso for $1.2 million. You know what else is really? Musical instruments. You go to the symphony, and some of these violins, these cellos are worth hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars. So what do investors do? Very wealthy investors. They buy a Stradivarius or a Guarnardi, whatever. They then loan it to the symphony. The symphony now has to buy the insurance or back up the price of the thing. They get to use it. Meanwhile, the damn thing keeps going up in price and price and price. But again, it's pure speculation because the symphony don't have that kind of money. They're just keeping the thing alive. But the one guy, anybody into the symphony? The first cellist at the San Diego Symphony has a Guarnardi. You heard of Stradivarius, that's for violins. Guarnardi are cellos. This thing is worth, I don't know how much. Outrageous. I forget that number. Somebody threw out and was like, I wouldn't want to touch it. Because they're not really that, you know, you could drop it and. So, you going to buy art as an investment?
No.
And so, the maximum capital gains tax rate on most all investments is currently 50%, 20% if you're making $600,000 or more. Could be as low as 5% or even 0%, depending on what your tax bracket is. But you have to pay 28% on gold, art, collectibles. And you can't put them in your IRA. So you think the Congress is trying to tell you something? Yeah, stay away. But, you know, you might be into... I had a student who said he was into comic books. He collected them. And, you know, with these collectors, they put them, they buy them, and they never read them. They just put them in these plastic things and store them away. He saw the very first, this was a million years ago, right? The very first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. He picked it up, and he looked at it. Nah. Because they come out with new ones every couple of months, right? And then they disappear. Damn. And this was 20 years ago. He said that thing would have been worth $9,000 now.
Wow.
Damn. Oh, well. Okay, so next week, we'll continue with a few of the odds and ends and discuss the final. And we'll have the questions for the final ready on the website. If you have any... Buy off all the brokers, please turn them in, and don't short stocks. Okay, who snuck in?